So I want to talk tonight about DNR orders. I don't want to talk about them in a comprehensive how-to fashion. What I want to do is give a framework as to how one might think about such issues, and then create the space for an approach which might be slightly different than the standard office presentation. It's a space which I enter with caution, great caution, and so I'm going to create the space for you, and then hopefully leave thinking about whether this is a space that you think I'll call it to enter or not. So let's begin by framing what the issue is. Right? Why would there be an issue with obeying a do not resuscitate order? So the answer to that, most boldly, is verse number one. A verse in Sefer Yisrael which says, "Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," which we can translate loosely but halakhically relevant fashion, "Do not stand idly by your fellow's blood," this formulation is important because it teaches us that there is not merely a positive obligation to save somebody's life, but a negative commandment against refraining from saving somebody's life. So the categories passive and active are not necessarily terribly useful in regarding to this, because on a legal framework, the act of failing to save is defined halakhically as the action of standing idly by, rather than a failure to fulfill a positive obligation, and that framework should have significant influence on the way in which we approach the issue. So there's a prima facie case that with regard to all other human beings, we have an obligation to save them. And that would seem on the surface to mean that do not resuscitate orders should always be invalid, because a do not resuscitate order, first sheets are on the surface, a do not resuscitate order should be treated as an order to violate a verse of the Torah. And therefore, you should not be able either to fail to save somebody yourself, or to enable somebody else to fail to save, which would be a violation of the same relative to the show, placing a stumbling block in front of the blind. Now, there is one fairly straightforward way to eliminate the obligation to save another human being, and that fairly straightforward way is to declare that person dead. Right? Since there is a fairly general consensus that there is no obligation to save people who are already dead. Not absolute. Not absolute, because there is a certain government there in Eliyahu HaNavi, which raises the question of how, since according to that Gemara, Eliyahu HaNavi was a Kohen, and we know that Eliyahu HaNavi saved the wife of his landlady after he was already dead, he brought him back to life, and the question Tosafot would ask is, how is it possible for Eliyahu HaNavi to become some innate, right, become ritually impure in the Kohen, if there's no mitzvah to resurrect people? So what justified him in becoming so innate with regard to that child? The answer also given that in fact there is a mitzvah to resurrect people. However, that mitzvah applies only if one is absolutely certain that one will resurrect them. So in a practical sense, it's probably the case that burying somebody dead, for most purposes, eliminates the obligation to save them. Although, which I wouldn't want to make absolute statements. Okay. So the easiest way in contemporary world to declare people dead is to use the criteria variously or originally known as whole brain death and now more conventionally known as brain stem death, using one set of criteria or another. I'm not going to begin to say a comprehensive survey of the brain death question either scientifically or halakhically tonight. That both because of issues of lack of confidence and because I don't think that's the main issue. For those of you who are up on the halakhic discourse, you should be aware that this is generally depicted as a dispute between two Rosh Yeshiva Yeshiva University, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, who is the prominent proponent of the use of brain death criteria, and Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, Rabbi J. David Bleich, who is the primary opponent. And I should make my own bias as explicit, I am a student of David Bleich. So therefore, right, I don't want to go into what I want to do, because it's useful for our purposes, is to read two selections, especially from the chair and back. I want to read two selections from an article that came out this March on the front page of the idea section of the Boston Globe. And these are citations from it. One says, quote, "The DCD protocol pretends that patients are dead at the time their organs are taken out. Says the University of Wisconsin Medical Ethics Professor Norman Claus, they're not. that the Robert Truog, Director of Clinical Ethics at Harvard Medical School and the Division of Children's Hospital Boston, is one of, I think at this point, more than a handful of local critics who believe that the medical community is misleading the public and living itself. With an arbitrary definition of death, it's completely ethical to remove organs from patients who diagnose as brain death with drug. It's just ethical for reasons other than that we think they're dead because they're not. There are a variety of philosophic issues embedded in this, which we're not going to do tonight. The first question is whether death is ever a physiological category rather than a legal category, and we can decide to say whether we want it, because we feel that meet the criteria of useful life that interests us, and so there may not be any necessary physiological criteria. That's the halakhic discussion. What is the criteria of death? And then there is a scientific discussion. What does it mean to declare somebody dead? And specifically, what do the criteria known as brainstem death measure? And are they measured accurately? There is a position which is represented well in the article that the Harvard criteria are not, it did not start with a definition of death and then arrive at the criteria they came up with. Rather, they started with the premise that transplants had to be possible, and then came up with a set of measurements that would declare the right, that would define the time at which transplants could optimally be conducted. And that would be considered death. I don't want to get into that controversy. You should be aware of it, and it plays out logically. The only thing I will say, as a bio student, is that on the practical question as it originally arose of what brain death measures, I think empirically all of the biased original contentions have now been demonstrated correct. But the issue then is, okay, even if his original contention that the brain death criteria didn't measure what they were originally claimed to measure, full lifeless of the brain and other sorts of issues, that may not affect the halakhic outcome. What I'm interested in tonight, though, is not so much brain death, because brain death covers only a very small set of cases in which DNR orders might be issued. Brain death is more relevant as a criterion for transplant issues. What Dr. Truog suggests in this article in response to his belief that brain death is not a legally significant criterion is that there may be situations in which it is permissible to take organs from people even though we acknowledge they are not dead. And the question, if you were to translate that question into the halakhic arena, the question is, are there people who are alive, but whom nonetheless one has no obligation to save? And are there people who are alive, but to whom the halakhic obligation of Talmud al-Dam Be'etha does not apply? Such that we can, and furthermore, I would say, I would like to create a space, although I may undo that later, we can ask the question, are there people who are alive and whom it is forbidden to kill, whom nonetheless there is no obligation to save and no negative economic against failing to save? Okay, and that would create the space, right, for DNR orders. Right, to claim, right, relating to say this patient is currently alive, but that does not mean that medically we have an obligation to take all means possible to maintain them in that condition. Okay. Now, how would we create such a space? First, we throw in the dark. So the narrative that is most often cited in this discussion is the story of Abdi Ben Trudion, which I give you here in relevant excerpt, but you should be aware that this is part of a very, very long narrative that goes on for several pages in the Talmud, and the story of Abdi Ben Trudion should not be read in isolation. But we're going to do it anyway. So tonight, they found Abdi Ben Trudion, who was sitting engaged in Torah, source number 3, and gathering great congregations with a Torah scroll lying in his bosom. They brought him and they wrapped him in the Torah scroll, and they heaped tunings on him, and they kindled a flame on them, and they brought tufts of wool and soaked him in water and placed him in a tart so that his soul would not leave rapidly. And then we have this really fun dialogue with his mother. They had really powerful lines, right, that he who seeks to redress the Torah will seek redress for me, that right, the scroll, the parchment is burning, but the letters are flying, all beautiful and not our issue tonight. But what matters to us is, at the end of that conversation, his students say to him, you should open your mouth and let the flames of the fire enter your mouth. And he says to them, better it be taken by who gave it than I wound myself. And that is often taken as a claim that we can say halakhically. Obviously, right, he did not feel it was an imperative to stay alive. Right? But he said that, right, but he was not willing to actively engage in a process that would lead to his death. And that's the issue with that is that it's, why is that the case? Why isn't, right, what happens to a Samuel Ben Reyesha? Right, why does it make a difference whether he's actively or passively, right, or passively allowing himself to die? It gets worse, because as the story goes on, right, the executioner then says to him, Rebbe, if I increase the flame and remove the testicle from on your heart, will you bring me to Olam Haba? And he replies, yes. He says, swear to me. And he swears to him, yes. If you take the testicle of wool off of my heart, then he will go to Olam Haba. And the executioner takes the testicle off from his heart and then goes to Olam Haba. So what happened to the passive active distinction? Right? He's telling him to remove it. And then the executioner, in order to get to Olam Haba, commits suicide. And still goes to Olam Haba. Right? So the notion is that, right, so everyone focuses on that first line, better that he who gave my soul should take it than I should win myself. But if you're going to take this narrative as positive, it teaches you not only, right, it teaches you that on occasion it's legal to actively remove things that prevent you from dying, and sometimes suicide is legal. So this is a very difficult narrative to take a special. Hold off for 1 minute. The difficulty of taking this narrative as precedent comes out, I'll take questions after the next page, emerges in, if you read two contemporary responses on this question. The first one is from Mr. Eliezer Waldenberg, the Sikh Eliezer, who is generally renowned as one of the great medical ethics postics, a post-team of the past 50 years. Apparently he got into it because he lived across the street from Sherry Kiddick in Yerushalayim, which is the thing where his wife got into it, by the way, because he took a shul that was right across from Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. And the other is from Moshe Feinstein. So this is the other response to a question as follows. Right? So somebody wrote him saying, I don't understand how, in the story of Rosina Ben Tranyon, how do you permit the executioner to build the plane and promise Olam Haba? I'm willing to concede, as a questioner, that I know, because I've read various English books on the subject, that we distinguish between passively allowing to die and actively killing, but that doesn't seem to work in this narrative very well. And that's his question. He points out that there are other places where it's clear that we don't treat an absolute obligation to stay alive. One is a story in which Rabbi Yossi ben Chalasta is asked by a very old woman whether there's a way in which she can die, because she no longer wishes to live, and he asks her, well, why do you think you live so long? And she says, I live so long because I go to shul every day. I daven every day in shul. It's also an interesting sociological phenomenon. And he says to her, well, stop going to shul. So she stops going to shul and she dies. So, all right, sounds like you can tell people to stop going to shul in order to die. Rabbi Penny also has a wonderful story about the elders of the city of Luz, which we should do in great depth at some point. Luz is a city of immortals. If you want, by the way, George Louis Borset has a wonderful short story based on the Gemara and the elders of the city of Luz called the City of Immortals. But the City of Immortals, the Gemara says along the way, the reason that Luz is the City of Immortals incidentally is because there's a whole set of symbols. Apparently there was a belief that even when the body is wholly destroyed, there's a little piece of the body that has to survive in order to make resurrection possible. That little piece is like a chestnut, so it's called the Luz. Right, so Luz is the city, right? So Luz is the city of immortals because of that. And in the city of Luz, the Gemara says that the angel of death was not permitted to enter. But when the elders got disgusted with life, they either went outside to bring the checking out or were carried outside the city and met the angel of death there. And that's where it's a little bit more problematic, because if you say they were carried out, so maybe that's passive. If you say they went out, that's it. We have precedent in these narratives. But if you want to, there might be a way of sustaining the distinction between passive and active in those other stories. But here he says, look, the same Ben-Tradion told the executioner to add wood to the fire to make it hotter, right, to make him die faster. So how am I supposed to explain this? So he says, the question is said, well, you know what, maybe your Nechid Ben-Tradion didn't really say yes. What he said was, I wouldn't object if you were to do that. So you can still view him as passive. So the supervisor says, come on, it could be thwarted him. And he's going to love if he does it. That's not going to work. So just the way he understands the response. Right? He says, I think the real way to answer this question is the Be'emet, Al-Pidin, really according to law, Hayyam Nukarlo, there are Chayyam Ben Chadion Lechavel Da'atmo. It was in fact legitimate for Chayyam Ben Chadion to wound himself. Right? It was legitimate to commit suicide. Can the Kosim Atosis begin Da'atman and Zayin? Atosis begin page 57 say, the hate of Uraim is during that when you are in terror of pain, which are a full batso, you're allowed to engage in self-harm. Rafayim and Shadion need us chasidus of us after you allow Mithurim Kashin to not want to get off the hair. So what this is saying is you can't derive anything from Rafayim and Shadion's refusal to open his mouth and have the plane enter him, because in fact, legally, he was allowed to. The whole distinction between passive and active failed. There are situations in which there's no obligation to preserve life, you can even allow suicide. So why did Rav Chaim Ben Chadion make this nice speech? Because it was a nice speech, and it was a profound gesture of heroism. If God wants me dead, he's going to have to kill me. Okay? That's the situation of this thing. You can't learn anything from Rav Chaim Ben Chadion because he was acting beyond what was required by law. Okay. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, that the only way to justify how Rav Chaim Ben Chadion could allow the executioner to act blamed is to say that Rav Chaim Ben Chadion acted in a way which isn't legal, but in extremis, he was entitled to suspend the law. Really, he wasn't allowed to tell the executioner either, right, to include the claim, but there was an emergency ruling that he was allowed to do this. So you have one person who interpreted actions by claiming that he went beyond the letter, that he acted beyond what was required by law, and one person interpreted the story by saying that you can't learn anything from his actions because his actions were against the law. What you learn from this in the end is that you can't derive law from narrative. Right? Because you can do this any narrative, right? Any narrative you can claim, right? Either the characters acted beyond what was required by law, or they acted on the basis of emergency measures. So the attempt to derive principles from narratives in this case, to me, is a failure. And one should simply cease the effort and accept that what you derive from the weight of a whole set of narratives is that there is, right, is that the Talmudic sense is clearly that there are circumstances in which life is not a good. Right, not a good. You have so many stories in which the outcome of death is presented as legitimate and desired. Right? The elders of Lewis leave the city. However they leave the city, whether they should have left the city or shouldn't have left the city, they wanted to leave the city. Living forever was not right. Living forever did not seem to have a reward. The lady who lived a really long time, a very firm lady, who lived a very long time, said, I'm very grateful that God has rewarded me, and now I'm going to stop doing the things that make God reward me with life. And these people are not presented as insane, right, as depressed, as sick. Right? So I think that what emerges from the narrative is not, like, the attempts to derive technical law from narrative are always going to fail because you can do this any narrative. You can always claim a narrative does not reflect law. But on the value level, it seems to me that it's clear that there are circumstances that the Talmud does not view life as an absolute good. Okay, so we're left with the question, right, under what circumstances can we claim that there is no, right, granted that life is not always a good, but doesn't mean that I don't have a logic obligation to save somebody. It just means I don't have a presumption that it's always the right thing to save somebody. As always, the goal is to arrange, right, if I can find legal ways out, there might be circumstances in which I would look for technicality. Okay, now there are a whole bunch of questions that were being held up. Adina, Andy, or Redmond. Adina, do you have a question?
I think my question was answered. I think I was going to ask you whether it's challenge acceptable to you? Like whether there's any sort of sensible question like when you leave the acceptable and versus when you leave.
Okay, good. So we'll get there. Good. Yes.
There is a slight distinction between where you can aspire to one more an active goal where you would, you know, open and tell and be the actual person to do it on my side, depending on the way you tell it together.
So you can try that, then you have to justify the executioner jumping into the plane. The executioner goes... Well, he doesn't just tell him you can. He promises him... usually halakha, appointing an agent is considered to be the same as doing your own action. You can try it. But it's not terribly compelling because you're appointing an agent. And then the premise of the story seems to be that the executioner does the right thing too.
But the executioner
does the executioner then commits suicide.
But then
right?
Maybe he got his sexual papa through doing his job. And suicide is irrelevant to that.
I don't know. Usually, illegitimate suicide is usually going to lose your family in a long ago.
Maybe it's because of the
okay. If you want to make it survive, you can try it. I'm just pointing out that particularly as a Rav Moshe tell you that any evidence you bring from this narrative, they can just get rid of. Right. So right. If you bring any of this...
That's beyond this particular narrative.
At all. Exactly right. That's why I want to write. And in this particular narrative, they go out of their way to do it.
Okay. Another observation. I mean, again, this is further out, but we could say that it wasn't... it's interesting. It says it should be a sham. Whoever gave it, there would be things like that he who gave it.
Yeah.
There's legal
rules that
you send
the
executioner to make an
overture. So you use the executioner as a pawn. Okay, that's clever. The difference between, you could read it that way, but compelling, they got rid of the notion of compelling. That's my argument. Once you see how Rav Moshe, the story of Panatesha doesn't seem to work so well, and Rav Moshe and Sisulayazer basically tell you that even if you found a way of reading it where the distinction was clear, we would just ignore it.
All right. Well, I mean, so in terms of law, whatever it says, it's not going to hold up because it's a narrative. Like,
yeah.
In terms of the same narrative, in terms of self understanding your motivation.
Okay, I'm going to continue those possibilities. But right now, just a lot of people are not going to get anywhere easier.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, they're not very good. Yes.
Is it possible that the standards for suicide and murder are different from a non-Jew and from a Jew?
Yes, the Russia tries that and then rejects it.
Okay. B, is it possible that Lota Ana Brecha and Shakir does not apply when you're talking
about... Mimo Samarov Dana Echa.
Sorry.
Maybe it's no self-obligation as opposed to somebody else. Right. But you don't have to save yourself, other people have an obligation to save you. I don't think that has been tried very much. A lot of people have thought of it, but it's a possible technical solution. I haven't seen anybody try to do that. Right, rationally it should be there, but I haven't seen anyone try it. Yes. Yeah.
So I understand the executioner, what would happen if you were not jumped into the plane? You'd be tortured by the Roman government, and therefore you could get the...
All right.
And it would be the term not good. But the dementia, not only is it an understanding of how you get the executioner, but also, given that I'm by Rabbi Kenia, then therefore he's making a rough shot, which is very
in the yeah, so that's an interesting question, right? Who is the person who tells the Rosh Hashanah is allowed to do this? That's a very good question, which Rav Moshe doesn't address. I agree with you. To me, it's more shows that Rav Moshe is really not going to be willing to let narratives decide law and this issue. He'll take pretty much any way out after right to grant the narratives being dispositive. Yes?
Here's a rabbi from Reno who's going to die. Either way, he died slowly or he died quickly. I mean, it's not possible to say that, I think, if you're going to die anyway. And therefore, there's no contravention of the do not stand by your fellow, but you must just rise to the
anyway.
Right, then we have to start making the claim.
It's possible that if somebody cannot be saved, it's okay to stand by and not...
Right, you can try and do that. You can try and do that. The issue then is you have to define... Right, if you could live even 10 seconds longer, then we have to try and define the line of length of life which is no longer useful, which is no longer legally meaningful, which people try, but it's a difficult thing to frame. Right? Why is it that 10 seconds of life is meaningless, but 10 minutes is meaningful? Right? Because you can save them for 10 seconds longer by not raising the flame. Right? So people try to distinguish between Chayei Sha'a and Chayei Olam. And I'm not, again, you can fit that into narrative. You could also claim that it's not what the narrative is based on because the executioner will live a little bit longer, right, if you think the executioner is, right. So my major outcome here is, if I thought this story should be dispositive evidence, I could find formulations that I found compelling, but the post-team went out of their way to tell you, no, don't do that. Right, they would, even if you have a compelling read of the story, they will eliminate it. Right, so as a matter of obvious methodology, it's not a compelling approach. Right, that's my argument. What the narrative means as such, because right, the problem is, again, you have to look at this narrative in the context, we're reading this narrative as if it were about law. But in context, this narrative is not about law at all. This is right, part of a whole long discussion of martyrdom. So maybe that the whole attempt to infuse law, I think the notion of situation may be entirely right, that the attempt to presume that characters in these kinds of narratives are behaving legally may be a category error. Right, because maybe this is not the kind of narrative in which people are presented as behaving legally. Yes?
Just because we move beyond narrative, isn't it problematic in that the person that's proving that we're basically carried out upon it or in terms of showing you should talk about the other than the fact that the primary subject is under duress? I mean, so...
Right, if you don't like that, right? How can you do it, right? How can you claim that he acted beyond the law, right? He acted against the law in the days of an emergency ruling. People get the days of emergency rulings when they're in pain. Right? It's not a... I don't know that you're arguing, right? You know, the whole point is the story's an unbearable agony. Do we, in fact, presume that even great rabbis always knew exactly the right thing?
Right.
Okay, right. I just wanted to do this because many of the presentations that you will read of Halakha on the subject will begin by citing this narrative and telling you, right, this is the source of the distinction between passive and active. Right, and I want to point out that's not true. Okay, there's a second thing which is very important to discuss, which is relevant to DNRs in the following way. There is a category in Halakha called the Gosish. A Gosish is somebody who is in some kind of dying process, and there are two things about it. One is that the Gosish, even though they're defined as dying, it is uncontroverted in Halakha that killing a gosage is murder. Right, the second thing is, the problematic notion, this is the superior of Moshe, is that we presume that touching a gosage has a significant enough chance of leading to their death to be considered murder. And that means that there are cases in which you cannot engage in the process of determining whether somebody has reached whatever medical status you want, say brain dead, because maybe they're not dead, and then by touching them, you're causing them to die. You can never find this out. Right, so I want to talk about this notion of the ghost as a being so delicate that if you touch them, they may die. Right, it also has consequences for pastoral surroundings, end-of-life situations, right? If you're really correct, then you might not be able to hold somebody's hand because that would touch them. Right, you can find this assumption starkly in Rav Moshe. Right, so Rav Moshe says the following, and this is an earlier part of the Tshuva we just read. In terms of what it means, what the signs are of the status of Gosei, he says, you know, I've heard that doctors have no idea what this means. Maybe because what, right, it's a truly legal, a lofty legal category, right? What implication does it have for the secular world? Now he says, what do you mean, what implication does it have for the secular world? Doctors don't want to kill people, right? So they're not going to, right, so they're not, right? So if in fact it was a patient, right, who, if you touched them, they would die, surely doctors would want to know about that. And he says, well, maybe the doctors don't know that this patient could die that way. And secondly, maybe even if they know that, they just don't think that that's really killing somebody. Anybody who could die if you place a finger on them is dead enough. Right, that's a suggestion. But it's a really interesting one. He says, the Torah observers should guard themselves. Yesh lehem lishamer, kishiyodin shloshayak, when they know there's no hope of healing, Because as long as there's a hope of healing, you can take the risk of killing them in order to heal them. But once you know that you're engaged purely with, say, in palliative care, right? So then, if you know that, then Verilin should go safe, and they see that the person is a ghost safe, should routinely go there and go safe, they should guard themselves. They should make sure not to touch this patient. So Chim Dumani, I imagine, should Rosima, if there are any from doctors that really want to know this, what they can do is, they can hang around hospitals where people frequently die, and eventually they'll pick it up. Now that's a really interesting halakhic formulation as to how to avoid murder. Right? Because you are frequently found in situations in which it is likely that you will kill people. So, and you don't recognize the signs. Well, if you really want to know how to avoid murder, I imagine that you can hang around long enough and eventually you'll pick it up. Right? There's a vast disproportion between right, the seriousness of the offense and the seriousness of the inquiry, which he's telling you to engage in. Which makes one suspicious about this category called ghost. Is there really such a thing as a patient, right, we genuinely believe, as a patient whom, if we touch them, they will die? So I just want to point out, make a halakhic argument, which I concede is, to the best of my knowledge, right now a minority of one halakhic argument, but maybe a red dark hole, right? If I'm right, then hopefully it will fit. So if you take a look, so where does this notion that it's forbidden to touch a ghost face come from? So I'm giving you this very briefly. Those of you who are really interested in the subject, I should say that my article on this subject is available at jewishideas.org, and you can find the link at tarreligious.org. So you can read the full treatment, all right, the full treatment of this issue. But if you take a look at the Rif in Shabbat, the Rif in Shabbat quotes the writer who says the following, a person should not shut the eyes of a dead person with together with the departure of the nefesh. Anyone who shuts the eyes with the departure of the nefesh is a bloodshedder. And this is the parable of this is you have a candle that is in the process of going out. A person puts his hand on it, immediately it goes out. Now, let me ask you a question. You got a candle flicker. Right? Flickering candle, flickering torch. You put your hand on the side of the candle. Candle go up? What does it mean? That you can put your hand on it, it goes up. You put your hand on the flame, it goes out, right? Okay, now let's read the next thing. Right here, there is in the Rosh in Moikata, I quote another bright day, which says, that a ghost face is considered like one with a life in all matters. Right? So the whole list of things that are part of the Tahara process, designed to preserve the body, right, prevent the body from rotting before burial. You can't do any of these things while it's still a ghost face. Right? Because that was you telling him. You can't treat him as dead when he's alive. The last of these things is, the Ein Ma'asin Ein Einav, you can't close his eyes. The Hanogeya both, and one who touches him is considered a bloodshedder. What is it similar to? So a flickering candle, and when a person touches it, immediately it is extinguished. So we have two different versions. One version of the text is a person puts his hands on it, and it's right, and closing the eyes is parallel to putting a hand over a flame. And another version of the text, which says that closing the eyes, right, and touching is like extinguishing, and is like killing, and that's like touching a candle. Okay. Now, the Rif and the Rosh actually both quote both versions. The Rambam, since it's verse number 9, says, the ghost is like one of the wise matters, they are no gay at all, raise their shafet tamim. Anyone who touches it is considered to be a bloodshedder. So, normal halakha would be, right, the Shulchan Aruch tells you the way he rules is, he takes the majority of the Rambam and the Rosh. Okay, well here we have a majority of 3 out of 3. They're all saying it's forbidden to touch a ghost. But when we go to the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch, they each say, the ghost is like one of the lies in all matters, and you can't close his eyes until the soul departs, and anybody who closes the eyes of the departure of the soul is considered to be a ghost shitter. No mention of touching whatsoever. Okay, now you can in context read the Rif, the Ram, and the Rosh as referring not to touching, but to touching that causes a significant body part to move. Right? It's really tanogea umezizo. My suggestion is that it's clear that the Torah Shulchan, right, it's quite striking that the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch read out the language about touching. Now, there is an interesting historical explanation of that, which is that actually you can trace that there are two texts of the primary source, one of which has touching it, and one of which has only closing the eyes. And it may happen to have been that the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch quoted directly from the text of the Braisa and didn't notice that the Ritz Ram and the Rosh had quoted from the other text. But on standard halakhic methodology, they have the Ritz Ram and the Rosh in front of them. They leave that section out. That means they don't rule that way. There is a way of understanding those texts in such a way which makes that line legally insignificant. Because among the things that you're not allowed to do to the ghost section of the earlier, you're not allowed to move them. Right? So you don't have to add in don't touch them because it's part of moving. So I want to suggest that the halakha should be that there is in fact no such prohibition against touching a ghost face, because there is no such person as a person who will die when touched, any more than there is such a thing as a lamp that will go off because somebody touched it on the side. And part of the reason Rav Moshe has no such threat is that the doctors can't figure out what it is, because there is no such thing. Like when the Rishonim talked about ghost face, they were talking about somebody who was in the dying process, such that if they were physically manhandled, they would die. That was a recognizable category. When people began defining a ghost as somebody who dies when touched, they couldn't find it anymore. Because there isn't such an animal. Yes?
How do you know
it's possible. All I'm pointing out is that I have a Torah and Shulchan Aruch, which are the standard halakhic sources, which don't mention such a prohibition. Right? I have a way of reading the text which is compatible with that continually. It makes the halakha conform to what we understand of reality. I would rather have the halakha turn out that way. But I have to tell you that this isn't, I don't know that there are other halakhic figures who would rule that way. It just seems to me to be what the truth ought to be. Yes? They're referring to touching that causes the sick person to move significantly. Then you have Yizo, somebody who moves him. Right? You have texts which say Anogea do umazizo. Where those two terms are assimilated. They have whole discussions about whether moving the tongue is enough, or you actually have to move one of the limbs. And I suspect that at least the Shulchan Aruch read them that way. Right, whether that's what they really meant or not, I don't know. But right, so otherwise, the Shulchan Aruch failure to mention the prohibition against touching is quite, right, against the Ritz, the Rosh, and the Rambam, right, is quite striking. And your normal halakha is to follow the Shulchan Aruch, right, as you read them. So I think that's the halakha should be. And if I haven't heard that said, but maybe that's other people come, maybe even it is normative, I just read the wrong book. I encourage you to ask anyone you find. And see what they think halakha is. Okay, so what we have so far is an absence of evidence. Right? We don't have a clear distinction between passive and active, and we don't have a prohibition against touching. So what do we have? So really, the halakhic source of the discussion historically is from it's generated by one text and a later citation of that text. There's no Talmudic. The reason that narratives get cited is because there is no halakhic Talmudic discussion of the issue. So you have a very interesting citation of Sefer Chassidim, which is a Neo-Ashkenazi work, which has tremendous influence on Ashkenazi halakha. The Sefer Chassidim, the first number 11, says the following. It starts off with a really interesting claim. Ein gormin la'adam, first number 11 of the Sefer Chassidim begins by saying, Ein gormin la'adam shlo yumut mehira. You write, one must not cause a person not to die rapidly. Okay, or an interesting double negative, right? So and he means it, right? He doesn't mean one must cause a person to die rapidly. Right? He means one must not cause a person not to die rapidly. Okay, as an example, suppose somebody were agnostic, whom we all know you can't make die faster, right? It's murder to make them die faster. And he's going to suggest that even though right, it's murder to make a ghost face die faster, it's also prohibited to make a ghost face die slower. Okay, or at least to prevent a ghost face from dying faster. And someone here in the house where there is this ghost face, somebody is chopping wood. Okay? They have the Shemayah for all of faith. For some reason, the sound of wood chopping prevents the person from dying. I do not wish to speculate on how this happened. I don't know the phenomenon. Thank God. You're allowed to tell the guy, stop chopping wood. Well, actually, it's quite thoroughly. You can pick the guy up and carry away. Right? You remove the wood chopper. Right?
Okay.
I was just telling my students about the summer I spent with a friend of mine holding an axe the entire time in camp. So, no one ever told us to stop doing what we were doing. But apparently, the thing that our brave people did. You can remove the chopper from me. Okay. And furthermore, not only can you remove the wood chopper, obviously, if you can remove the wood chopper, you can also choose not to put salt in his tongue, which apparently will also keep him from dying. The ego says, so near any akol amud, I should remove him from akher, how is he moving me shalom? Okay, if he's ghost-tipping saying, I can't die until you move me somewhere else, you're not allowed to move him. Because moving a ghost is considered to be, right, to be taking a risk of actively shortening his life. Okay, so say if the ended there, it would be pretty clear, and it'd say, oh, so you can't cause him to die faster, but you can remove things that will cause him to, right, that are preventing him from dying faster, and then we can try and figure out if that's the coherent distinction, right, between removal of a prevention and an addition. Probably the patient that's being goes on and says, in yesh tzlekah, if there's a fire, and in yesh tzlekah, you can't leave from the house, everyone must speak in with you, so you have to remove him. So if we wanted to formulate that in my initial off the categories and claim that there's a prohibition against murdering a ghost face, but there's no obligation to save the ghost face, why do we have to take the ghost face out of the fire? He just went to such effort to tell us, you don't do anything, right, that will prevent him, right, that will prevent him from dying faster, and here, right, eventually the fire has come along. And what you're doing is, right, you know, you're piling the wood on. Right, so he'll die slower. Okay, question, yes. Because what? So now it's going to get much more complicated, right? Because it's not just a question of whether you're causing him to die faster or preventing him, right, as opposed to preventing him from not dying faster. It matters what's causing him to die also. That gets really, really complicated. So now we have two factors we have to measure. So we can do that, but the story all of a sudden becomes complicated. Okay, what I want to read now is the paper has to begin as such had no influence whatsoever on the conversation. Nobody ever cited it. And basically, there's no evidence that anybody addressed this issue in any way halakhically until in the, the early 16th century, the Shulchan Giborim comes along and records that a she'ela that he discussed, and says, in the process of that she'ela, in which nobody had any evidence at all, he says, there's a sefer chassidim. And that at that point, the sefer chassidim becomes part of halachic discourse, and from then on, all halachic discussions have to relate to the sefer chassidim. Okay? So here's what the Shulchan Giborim says. We have to read this in detail because all subsequent discussions are built off this citation. So the Mikan, from here, it seems that from the prohibition in Moed Katan against treating a ghost as dead while he's alive. It would have been correct to forbid. Mashinoi Ksat Hashim, the custom which is practiced by some people, Kishanekilfed. Right, so you have confusion terminology. When the dead person is gilfed, right? So when the person will eventually die is gilfed. V'ena shamayi fell of fate, and the soul cannot depart. Sheshomtila karmi tachtav kdei shuvut meira. He shoved the mattress underneath him so that he will die rapidly. Uh-oh. Why not just shoot him? because they say because there are feathers inside the cushion that prevent the soul, they cause the soul to not depart. Okay, so they believe that by removing the pillow they weren't causing him to die faster, they were preventing him from not dying faster. Not such a clear distinction anymore, is it? Right, by removing the pillow, right, you are causing him to not die faster because you are taking away the pillows, which are not keeping him alive, but preventing him from dying, faster. Okay, the counter shall name Sakti Kikrofia, and any time they screamed like a rooster, well, Sir Hanegaras prevent this evil custom, but I'll love the idea, and it did not, arise in my hands. I did not find a way to do it. Now, at the end of this short thinking bar, there will be a whole question about whether, in the end, he changes his mind about this or not. Another suggestion is that even though you have a long theoretical discussion now, in the end, it's still forbidden because even if you're not worried about removing the bird feathers, the bottom line is, when you grab a pillow from somebody, they move. Right, so you're still moving a ghost face pretty significantly. And one of the things that you're not allowed to do to a ghost face is remove the pillows underneath them because that's moving them.
Yeah, the question isn't feathers and the properties of feathers as far as souls departing, part of your soul, but that lying on the cushion he's more comfortable, and so if you disturb him and remove the things that are making him comfortable, he'll have a harder time hanging
out. Right, so I think that's the real answer in the case. But for theoretical purposes, what we're interested in is why would somebody think that removing feathers which are keeping him alive is considered to be removal of an upset? How do we draw the line between between taking away something which is keeping him from dying faster and causing him taking away something which is causing him to die slower and causing him to die faster? Right, that's the challenge. Okay, since I hated this minute. But we have a psychological arrive, but my teachers said, no, my teachers were perfectly fine with this. There are rather nothing each Negro as well, so nothing the Hungarian family was a very major topic at that time. And he also wrote this is perfectly legitimate. So this, we have a fairly testimony that people felt, obviously, that there was no obligation of both Talmud and Rabbah in such cases. Right? That they thought it was perfectly legal to do something with the specific intent of the resulting in a person's earlier death. Okay, they're perfectly comfortable with that. He hated it. But he says, Akar Kamashanim, Matati, the Sefer Hasidim, Tiyuzarai, as after some years I found the Sefer Hasidim support for my words, Shekatuk Sham, Inu Gose, Beyoko, Lamut Ashish, and Ev Matomater, all you think of me, Sham. So he can even leave that to the woodchopper. Right, for now, and he says, look, it says you can't move a person to another place. If he says, I can't die until you move to the other place, you can't move to the other place. Now, it seems to him, guess what? What the person is saying is, this place is keeping me from dying. So we're not making him die faster by moving him away from that place. We're preventing the place from keeping him alive. And what's the difference between removing the feathers, right? If I can't remove the person from the place, I can't remove the feathers from the person. Right, that's his initial argument. But then he says, but the Sefer Chassidim actually isn't so coherent. Now I have three cases. So I'm allowed to, I can't move the person from the room, but I can move the woodchopper from the person. What does it matter? Right? The whole point is, there's something preventing the soul from departing. Either I can remove it or I can't remove it. Right? In no way, in either case, am I adding a factor, as they understand it, which is causing the person to die. I'm removing a factor which is preventing it from dying. The room, right? The room, the room, the woodchopper. So he ends up saying, well, Sabra Sapidim is just incoherent right now. I don't have a distinction that works. He says, El Shiyat the Tarek Tachi Belomar. So in order to make the Sabra Sapidim coherent, in order to find a way to make the claim that you can remove a woodchopper from a person, but you can't remove a person from a room. And he says this all. And he assumes that the reason you can't move the person from the room is not because you can't move him. But because you can't move him from the room. I would argue that the solution of Sefer HaSafin is quite simple. You can't move the person because that's if they're actively killing him. The room is irrelevant. But he didn't mean it that way. Okay, so he says, it's certainly forbidden to do something that will cause that the ghost will not die rapidly. So it's certainly forbidden to chop the wood. And it's certainly forbidden to put the salt on his tongue. Okay, so the first stage is, you're not allowed to do things to keep the ghost alive. Then he says, aha, and it seems to me, anything you would not be allowed to do, you are allowed to remove. So, since the woodchopper would not have been allowed to start, I am allowed to remove the woodchopper. Since the salt should not be there, I'm allowed to remove the salt. However, nobody said he wasn't allowed to be in that room. Right? He was in the room all along. So I can't remove the room because the room didn't get there illegitimately. Right? So it's an interesting move. Right? Any method of keeping him alive that shouldn't have been there in the first place, I can remove. But if the situation actually deteriorated, or incidentally, probably, if the woodchopper was there all along. And you could claim that, no, the woodchopper wasn't there alone, because the axe was down, now the axe is up. So they can always do every act of chopping wood as a new act, and you're not allowed to chop wood, so we can remove it. Okay, that's his distinction. His claim is, anything that you would not be allowed to do because it would keep him, right, because it would keep him from dying, you can also remove to cause him to die. So if you're going to hold, say, is Shari Lassira Groma Havu. But to cause something that will cause his death rapidly is forbidden, and therefore you can't move the ghost because you're moving him. Right? Alright, so far we're pretty happy, then he throws in another case, which is going to make life even more complicated. Alright, now he has a formulation he's happy with. You can't cause him to die rapidly. You can't cause him to not die rapidly, and if you did something to cause him to not die rapidly, you can remove it, and that removal is not considered causing him to die rapidly. It's considered not causing him to not die rapidly. Okay, now we have a new case. He says the same reason that you can't move the ghost, right, because that would be causing him to die, and so far we're almost clear. Also, you can't put the shul keys under his head. So you'll die faster. So this also causes him to die. Now, I am not an expert on superstition, but it seems to me the reason you put keys under somebody's body is because they're locked in. Right? And these keys are letting them out. The notion that putting the keys causes him to die faster as opposed to remove some kind of metaphysical obstruction seems deeply implausible to me. Right? It seems to be pretty clear that you've raised that you put that whatever the symbolism of keys is, keys where you remove an obstruction as opposed to causing something. So at this point, the distinction between removing an obstruction and causing something becomes, to my mind, utterly incomprehensible. But he says it, and all the real office is built off this. You've got to take it into account. Right, he says, why? So according to this, there's something there that causes the soul not to depart. You can remove that cause. This is meaningless. Because you're not doing anything. So I'd be very clear what not doing anything means here. Not doing anything doesn't by any means mean not doing anything. Right? Because not doing anything can mean, right, can mean, you know, picking up a woodchopper and dragging them away, right? Right. Oh, right. Taking the salt off the person's tongue, putting the keys under the person's head. And all this is not doing anything. Not terribly clear. But it's a, right, but he's trying to create this categorization, right, and there's something there that obviously that is driving him. You can make your own decision as to whether in the end he thinks it's okay to remove the pillow or not. But he thinks there's something really here which enables you to distinguish between the positive and the double negative. Right? There's a difference between causing something and removing an existing cause of the opposite, even if we don't have a clear formulation. It's not passive active. Right? It's not passive active at all. Right? It's a difference, I would suggest, between murder and failing to save. Okay? But there's no formulation that works here. Okay, there are more. The new citation of this, right? It's a Shulhara, but it's really the Ramah. I skipped into the intermediate stage, which is the Ramah text, it's in Darkei Moshe, and then right now Shulhara, he formulates that legally. Broader discussion is whether his citation in the Darkei Moshe is exactly the Shulchan Giborim or not. I originally thought that there was no way to square his citation, that it must have come from a different source. But none of the librarians in Wayu can find another edition of the Shulchan Giborim. So I think in the end I have to believe that the summary in the Darkei Moshe is somehow a fair summary. It actually would be a legitimate direct derivation from the Shulchan Giborim. So I'm just going to skip that and move straight to the Shulchan Aruch. So Amos says the following. The same absolutely grown on Mei Shemot Meheras, also forbidden to cause a dead body to die fast. To go on Mishu goes to Ma Aruch Lo Yechali Parade. First in the criteria. Somebody has ghost faced for a long time, not any ghost face. But in the paper of Hasidim, the Shulzegi Burim, it's just a person who ghost faced and is told can't die. We don't know what that means. It seems to be probably a subjective claim. I think I should be dying and I can't. Right? But the Ramah puts a new criteria. Somebody has ghost faced for a long time. Now, we don't know a long time. It is maybe, since some people define ghost face as somebody who is supposed to inevitably die within 3 days, that somebody who has a ghost face longer than 3 days is alive when they shouldn't be. Okay, so somebody who lives a long time, the Lord is following his parade, and he can't separate into body and soul. After he's trying to come, he kept it in the tuck. Okay, so he rules, you can't take the pillow off. Mikach shom initiation of the pillow, because some people claim that removing the pillow somehow keeps him alive, and so removing the, right, so removing those feathers is not considered removing a cause of dying slower, right, removing a cause of dying slower, but instead causing him to die faster. You can work on it as long as you want. The pain will even get him in tomo. Also, you shouldn't move him from place. The pain also will soon have to close Pepe here just for fun, I like to suggest. I have no idea why putting the keys under his head, the keys of the shul under your head would cause you to die, but I can understand why putting the keys of the cemetery on your head would cause you to die. And I'm wondering if the original text should not have been Beit HaKnesset or Beit HaKmarot, and you're supposed to put the keys in the cemetery. It's a totally unsourced suggestion. If there are any folklorists out there who can discover in some other culture, or if they believe in the connection between keys and death, particularly if you could find that distinction in 16th century Italy, I'd be very happy. Because we only have one text, and that text is Zed Eichhoff Nun, so I'm not copying it. But nonetheless, it seems to me to make a lot of sense if it were true. Can't do more than that. Okay. Friend? My wife has suggested that maybe it's just that maybe this is right in Christian circles, the burial ground is often adjacent to the shul. Right, and so maybe there was a borrowed custom, right, which there people misunderstood, right, was really the keys to the cemetery, because the keys to the church are the same as the keys to the cemetery, but we don't, right, but in Jewish circles for the Kohanim, the shul and the burial ground are distinct, but the belief got carried over without the rationale.
I've actually seen cemeteries and where the cemetery expanded such that it was
they started
off a separate
entrance. Okay. Could be
cars like that, some of the new school
Okay, so maybe even the claim the keys to the shul in the shabbat in the shul that you were insult really meant because the shul is the keys to the cemetery. Yes.
I don't know, so whatever it's worth. I once heard that Saddam was saying he got plastic keys to the soldiers for that they should die.
Okay, yeah, that is. Okay, I don't know. Thank you. Yeah, it seems like a very reasonable.
So it travels around
all these. Yeah, it seems like a very reasonable right, belief to me. I just don't really know if you have that kind of right there. If you want some kind of symbolic way of helping somebody die, you give them keys. And that seems to me reasonable. Keys to the cemetery seems to be the best bet to me. If I was, you know, I don't know how to do symbolic magic, so I can't. I can't tell you though. Okay. In Yesh Tavar Shegorem, it could be Piyat Nefesh, but if it's something that is causing the delay in the departure of the soul, and Shegorem, it could be Piyat Nefesh, like you don't put, like you don't change the muscle to die, not to die cold to fit. Like there's a pounding noise next to the house. You don't put it, it seems like a wood chopper. Or if Yesh Melech Alashino, the salt and the sun, they will not bring it yet a nefesh, mutar la siromisham. It is permitted to remove it. Okay, now there's a new formulation. Okay, the formulation we had in the Shibboleth Lekki was this is not an action. But this is not an action made no sense at all, because there were many actions, right? So that, the rest of the words didn't capture the idea. The Rambam offers a totally new formulation. He says, Ve'ein b'zeh ma'aseh klal, this is not an action, why? Ela shemetir hamoneh. What you're doing is removing the obstruction. Okay, so right, so people try and desperately distinguish between the positive and double negative, and you can make distinctions between positive and double negative. It gets complicated because you try and argue that removing extraordinary means is removing obstruction, but removing food is actively killing. Right, you have to define what the default setting is that you're removing. It's not a terribly productive endeavor, but people try it, and it is legitimate in the Ramah. Right, the claim that we're distinguishing between removal of obstruction and activity. But now, let's come up with two cases, right? Let's suppose we really believe this. We really, really believe, right, his language, he says, that if you're made pure monea, right, this is not an action at all, because you're just removing an obstruction. So we have a classic case, logically, right? I shot an arrow into the air, I thought, right, I let it fall. On this person, I tied up on the thing, but they had a shield in front of them, I shot the arrow. Now I remove the shield. What am I doing? I'm just removing an obstruction. Right? You all understand, right? You can't kill people. You just say, oh, you can do anything, you just remove an obstruction. Right? So the notion that simply finding a way which is technically not an action should allow you to kill people as such, right, is just not sustainable. You can't claim, right, if you're claiming that the reason that this works in the Ramah is simply that this is not considered an action, so it's okay, then it follows you have to claim this is not just, it's not just okay for a ghost face, it's okay for anybody. Right, as long as you can engage in an action which is defined as removal of an obstruction, you're on free. Right, that just can't be. Right, it can't be that the question of whether you can kill somebody or not depends on how clever and how epic imagination you are. Right, it just can't be. Now, there are cases that come out like this in Israel. Right, the standard stuff is, they don't want to remove respirators, God forbid, because that would be active. Right? But so what they do is they put all the respirators on a Shabbos clock. And this is what the Knesset Committee came up with. All the respirators on a Shabbos clock. And so you have to turn the respirator, you actually have to reset the respirator to keep it on, so if they decide not to resuscitate somebody, they just won't reset the Shabbos clock, and it's over being passive.
Is that non-Jewish?
Yeah, I find it, if that were the solution, right, would we really say that if you tied somebody up generally, right, you held them in a hyperbaric oxygen tank, right, and you just fed the Shabbos clock to keep the, right, to keep the flow of oxygen going for an hour, and you just don't turn it back on, I didn't kill him. You couldn't say that, right?
Why is it turning off the respirator
if you're
losing oxygen?
Oh, good.
You're lying about it, and...
Good, then we have it, right?
Good. Then we have, like, that gets us into the scuba, diver question. Ah, okay. So what I want to claim is, that there are really, two criteria you have to look at in every case. One is, you have to look at how you engage in the debt. Right? And two is, you have to look at whose debt you're causing. And the problem is, if you're looking for coherence, coherence works with either of these two criteria. Either we say, this is a person whom you don't have to keep alive, and it doesn't matter how you fail to keep them alive, or you say, this is not an action. Right? To try and find intersection and claim, there are some people whom you can kill in this way, well, either it's killing or it's not killing, right? If it's not killing, then you should be able to kill anybody that way. So the challenge, halakhically, is to try and construct the formulation which allows you to say you need both criteria. You need a specific kind of person, and even that specific kind of person, right, you can only kill in certain ways. So the example, this by the way, last summer, so this shows you have a specific interest in this topic. So the example I gave my students, just to really make this graphically, is that scuba diving is always one case, when people want to address the stress where it is. The other case is assault. We know that we have an obligation to rescue somebody whose life is being threatened by somebody else legitimately, to the point of shooting them. So imagine there's a patient lying on the bed, hooked up to the respirator, and somebody comes in, points a gun at the patient. You're sitting by the bedside. You quickly pull your own gun, shoot that person, and then pull the plug. Right? After all, they're rodents, right? They're trying to kill us, right? They're trying to kill this patient. That's murder. That's illegitimate. Bang, right? Got to kill it, right? But I don't really want this person alive, right? Then you pull the plug, right? That's the absurdity which one is driven.
That by the distinction of means, right? That you can genuinely, right, you have an authentic obligation simultaneously to shoot somebody for trying to kill them, and then an authentic right to pull the plug. That seems really, really hard to imagine. So, I wanted to present to you two contemporary attempts to offer a different formulation of the Ramah, to try and define the distinction between an action and a mesir monea, not in terms of the action, but in terms of the patient. Okay, so the first of these is the Tzitzil Yezer again. Alright, Tzitzil Yezer says, the Kara Chiloku, the essential distinction is, Bein Kishitatulato, Mesir Rak Hagorin Hachitoni, She'inenu Mevilo Chiyutasmi, whether you are removing the cause, whether your action or your work is removing only the external cause, which is not bringing him independent life. You're not allowed to provide external life to such a patient. So in such a case, you can remove it. Okay, so you can do whatever is necessary to prevent the patient from being kept, right, from having life infused to them externally. However, when a patient has any form of independent life, so the situation says you can do anything which prevents the infusion of external life, but you can't do anything which speeds the removal of internal life. And the nature of the action is irrelevant. Now that, here's the theoretically valuable formulation. The problem is just, what do you define as external life? How do you distinguish between a patient on a respirator and a scuba diver? Right, it's a very, very, it's right, it is, it solves many of the problems sexually, but it yields an almost impossible standard. It seems to me, although everyone I've spoken to rejects my reading, but it seems to me that the implication of Sintelezer clearly is that if you have a patient who has, the only time you can remove a respirator, and Sintelezer is dealing with the removal of a respirator from a patient who is not brain dead. He was not brain dead, who has a revised autonomous, and was revised autonomous heartbeat, but not autonomous respiration. And he says that you can remove the respirator. Indeed, he says there's an obligation to remove the respirator. So there's a different discussion which he talks about, which requires temperature, that he believes that there's a loss of dignity when your body loses its autonomy, which is a much more complicated philosophic notion that would need a separate shiur. But he says, in such a case, you're obligated to remove the respirator, but he says, and you don't remove the respirator only because the patient has no independent life whatsoever. It seems to me that there's no way not to be simply under saying that it's okay to shoot that patient. Because if you shoot the patient, you're not taking away their internal life. You're just removing the external life. Whether you remove the external life by turning off the oxygen or by exploding the heart, it shouldn't make a difference. Because the whole point is that the way he defines it is that it's murder to remove independent life. And there's no obligation whatsoever to maintain external life. So, right, so the situation just solves the problem.
How are you counting the external?
He claims, or he believes that a patient on a respirator with no capacity for autonomous respiration is being kept alive externally. But again, it's a category which has absolutely no objective cause.
Isn't that shooting the respirator?
No, I need to shoot the patient because...
That's not...
No, his claim is the reason you can remove the respirator is that this patient has no independent life. So if I shoot them, I'm also not removing independent life. Because obviously if the heart was providing them an independent life, then I couldn't remove the respirator either. Because...
Oh, then providing
them
independent life, you could remove the respirator and
extend life. Mm-hmm. Right, that's the point. So his claim is the fact that the only reason I can remove the respirator is that they're not really alive. Well, they're not really alive. I can shoot them. Right? You know, the simply hasn't walked into that distinction, right? You know, and there's no way out of it. And there's no way. Once he tells you that it doesn't matter what you do, the nature of the action is irrelevant. The clinician and the folks... No, it's not about that. That is not the receiver. He thinks that it's about whether this patient is alive or dead. If the patient is alive, then you must keep them alive by all means necessary. And if the patient is dead, I think, leaving aside the issues of pain and dignity, yes. Right? Leaving aside the issues of, you know, so it probably wouldn't be a good idea to shoot them because that's messy. And, right. So you could shoot, but you could certainly inject them with a poisonous drug. Right.
Are you allowed to inject
many
people
with poison? What? What do they care? And well, you'll leave a mark. Alright, okay, yes. Yeah.
The whole idea of being tense, they're talking about all these different situations or scenarios at the time that they were living in and trying to define it. Which is the things we're trying to do now in our time. And the whole idea of being tense, when you're talking about shooting somebody, that would be equivalent to putting out the flame. That's still an active action of
but they did. But they not.
This is talking about somebody's death. I thought this whole thing applied to somebody was
but the Sicilianist says that the reason you can remove the respirator is that they have no independent life, and he tells you very clearly it doesn't matter whether you're doing being active or not. All that matters is that the patient has no independent life.
But you could
say that the reason
that
you could
remove the respirator is that corporate in the process of dying, that is equivalent
to actually exactly
the heartbeat.
Sure, so is the heartbeat.
That you're able to remove it.
Right, and you can remove the heartbeat too.
The heartbeat isn't an artificial factor.
But he claims that if there were any, if it had theosophy culture, if there's any independent life, right, that's just one reason. I don't know. But that's quite right. That's what he's doing again. Again, the thing to work out is, again, you have to understand the paradox we're all stuck in. Is that you have two axes along which you can define this. Right? And if you define, and there is no coherent way to require both.
But why not try and come away from the halakhic aspect and look at this and what the halakha is trying to do and try and think of the main way to do this?
I could do that, I just thought he hadn't gotten there.
You're in the middle of the line, so you want to switch this around and just share a lot and look at this in terms of the other way that people are looking at this is try to look at the humane way of doing this and then try to apply a law to that rather than it being the last one first. The humane way of what they're saying is we don't do anything when we're closer to the fact of dying, we don't we don't actually we also don't really prolong their suffering. I mean, the whole idea of the wood chopper and the whole idea of the feathers and the whole idea of the keys,
we're not allowed to put the keys under, right? Be very careful.
So maybe, you know, if you hear the wood chopper, maybe it's somebody chopping down the tree to make your coffin, which is going to make you suffer more. Maybe the idea of the keys is the whole idea that if you're in this act of lying, you're actually aware of the fact that you may be in the act of lying. Anything that makes you suffering more should not be allowed.
Well, that
you're not allowed to do anything that
should. Right, so that
which is a humane way of doing it. Now we've moved into the level of nowadays where you don't really know what somebody's conscious state is, if they're going to distract it because you've got them on the respirator.
So I would say, again, there are lots of different, you know, there are lots of different things going on here. The first issue is, as a halakhist, I have to write, the goal of all halakhists is to make laws. And that intuitively, we might all know what to do in 95% of the circumstances, right? The problem is halakhically, if I frame the law badly, I will end up causing people to die illegitimately in 5% of cases. So even if I know intuitively where I'm going, I have to come up with a formulation.
So I understand that, but what I'm trying to say is when they were trying to make the halakha, you can't take away from it that the fact that they were trying to do it was also trying to, they can't remove the fact.
I understand that. I understand they were trying. I just pointed out they didn't succeed. they're trying. It just doesn't work. Yes, Rob.
So the definition of not having independent life,
yeah,
depending on how you take it, you could potentially have situations which we would all agree are people who are very much alive and have great quality of life, and yet, but they are dependent on...
Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking
has independent life. No, he has independent. How do you tell the difference? This is the Shelley. How do you distinguish between zombies and live people? Right. Zombies are externally applied life. I don't know. All right. Again, all I want to do...
I got to do one more story. All I want to do is point out that there is a halakhic bind here. And that, right, the halakhically, you should either have to define the mechanism or the person. And either way, you yield impossible results. When you define by mechanism, you end up killing legitimate people. And if you define by person, you end up being allowed to shoot people. Nobody wants to do that. Right? So what's up? I gotta read
the last verse. I don't think it's a question. Last verse. Okay, this last verse is the Rechaim Dezer Halevi, the author of Tehillah Harav. He was a starting chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. I regret that I couldn't dig out the Hebrew again for yourself with my translation. And so if you find this utterly beyond belief, then you'll have to blame my translation. He says the following. This is before anyone came up with brain death. He died, I think, in the early 80s, but this trivia is written in the 70s. It's a speech in which the convention rabbis asked me, were really all hung up about taking off respirators, right? It seems such a really scary thing. And they put it and say, no, don't worry, it's a mitzvah. Right? And here's how he says it. Right? He says, while Halakha discusses the ghost with the life owing to his own powers, and therefore has great agony, but in our case he feels no pain or suffering. This is right again for a different discussion, why we assume it's for the good of the patient to detach them from the machines when they are, by definition, incapable of experiencing anything. It seems to be a very problematic notion, and we should be much more open that generally the reason we detach is either for the good of the family's emotions or to save resources. The piety that we do for the sake of the patients requires a metaphysical belief in limbo, which it seems to be unlikely that most hospitals have. Okay, well, I want to just say, where in our case, it feels no pain at all. Nonetheless, it seems that you have to ask, and not only is it committed to a detachment from the respirator, but even if there is an obligation to do so, for indeed the nefesh of the human being, which is the property of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, has already been taken by HaKadosh Baruch Hu from the human being. As behold, he will die immediately once the machine has been removed. Quite the reverse. By this artificial respiration, we are leaving the nefesh within him and causing its suffering because it is unable to separate and return to the place of rest. Therefore, it seems to my impoverished intellect that it's greatest to me when you have reached a clear conviction there's no room for doubt or challenge, there's no longer room for the human being to be healed, to detach him from the respirator, and you can do this with no pangs of conscience. So the federal living basically says the same thing as the Sicilian answer, but it's a new formulation. It's not artificial versus, it's not an external versus independent life. It's whether God has already taken the soul or not. Yes. But in the end, but how do you know? How do you know that God has taken the soul or not? What is the criteria? If the angel is soul, why can't you shoot him? But it seems to be pretty clear, right? The angel no soul, right? It's the undead. So try to get a silver bullet, try to snake for the heart, whatever it takes.
Is that straight illegal for somebody to try to stop beating that woman? With exactly the same and have this
shot? Yes. Right, well, I want to explain this. This is what I want to emerge, then I'll take questions. I'll emerge as follows. The standard distinctions that are provided in halakhic discussions as to the means, the modality of causing the death, don't hold up. On the other hand, the alternative attempts to do it on the basis of a person are practically unsustainable. They're theoretically sustainable, right, but they're practically unsustainable. So the challenge is, right, that there isn't really a coherent way of doing this. What you need is, and that's what intuitively everybody comes to, you need some kind of combination which we can say, you can, right, you can do it in this fashion, right, you can do it in this fashion for that kind of person, even though nobody has yet come up with the halakhic formulation that enables that to be, because intuitively what we're saying is that there is a category of people whom it is, a category of people whom it is forbidden to murder, but there is no obligation to save. Right, that's what I want to suggest. That's what has to emerge halakhically, even though to date the attempts at formulating that have not been successes. And it's possible, you know, there are times in the legal system when you're in the process of responding to a new reality, when you know pretty much where you have to go, but no one's found a way to get there yet. Right, it's my understanding of where halakha is right now that people pretty much know where to go, and it's actually quite radical. We just, in a different share, we could talk about morphine drips, right, which are another way of testing this, where I have to say that the Shlomo Zalman Orbach has a tshuva which simply terrified me, in the extent to which he's willing to commit. I would never be willing, I don't think, to go anywhere near as far as he is. But it seems to me that, you know, that the tenor of the halakhic discussion is much less life at all costs than is often presented. The distinctions that are often offered to justify halakhic distinction rarely hold up to either logical or textual analysis. On the other hand, there is an intuitive sense, and this intuitive sense is rooted in the Sefer Hasidim already, and then the Shulchan Kibbutzim, right? You have a tradition already for 500 years that there is a distinction, right? In Ashkenaz at least. Now in Sfarad, there is no record of any such distinction, right? But the Ashkenazi halakhic tradition, at least for 500 years, maybe for 800 years, is that somehow there is some way of distinguishing a category of people whom one does not have to keep alive by all means, despite the fact that for all people you have a table of Tavol Dam Reifa. Now, once you have that category, so there are all sorts of interesting implications. One of the reasons I actually developed this was not only the end of life issues, but because it seemed to me, and I actually knew right now, I think it's public, that at least in America, the Orthodox rabbinate was going to enjoy, even those bodies which have previously endorsed brain death are going to remove it, they're going to withdraw their endorsement. The Israeli chief rabbinate is still in favor, how far the chief rabbinate support gets you in the Orthodox community as opposed to allowing Charizard to go on, I don't know. But right, in America, even the Rabbinic Council of America has at least publicly begun debating the question of whether it ought to withdraw its endorsement of brain death criteria. That yields a result in which you will have halakhic rulings in which people will be forbidden to donate their organs under most circumstances. But nonetheless, to my knowledge, nobody has ruled that it's forbidden to accept them. Israel has a very serious issue. Israel has a transplant imbalance in Europe, which causes Israelis to have a very long waiting list because the percentage of organ donations in Israel is much lower than the percentage in other European countries, precisely because of this issue. Now, when the halakhic organ donation society began, I did not find the cards because I was unwilling to accept brain dead. I was good in early life, and because from my amateur scientific investigation, I thought early life was right. But on the other hand, the situation in which the entire community will end up being refusing to donate, but apparently being willing to accept, even though it seems to me that acceptance of organs should be considered a place, if many of them say they're very aware that 15 sinners in murder, if you really think that removing the organs is murder. So it seems to me that what is needed halakhically is a way of allowing transplants from patients who are not considered dead. And it's possible that the Tutsilyevna and the, and this goes back to the second source I quoted, is the same way that the secular critics of brain death are now trying to create a category in between life and death. It seems to me that it's possible that the Tutsilyevna and the kind of a lady have now created a new category of people who are not quite dead. Right? Although mostly dead. Yeah, for those of you who have seen The Princess Bride. Where that is clearly a case of externally applied life, right? But that's where I want to leave it. I think that it's clear that halakha allows, probably even encourages, situations in which the goal is to enable people to die as opposed to keep them alive. There's an intuitive feeling about who those people are. And there's also an intuitive feeling that even when you have a result, not all means are legitimate to get you to that result. But nobody has yet come up with the lines, halakhically, which enable you to predict in advance on the basis of law, as opposed to intuition, which case is which. Okay, now I'll take questions. That has probably been a question for a long time.
Yeah, I just, just a very good understanding of the that would be sustainable. I think what he's saying is that there are different stages, there are different streams of life. There's breathing, there's blood, the heart flowing, there's the spiritual side. So if he's not breathing on his own, he's going to call him an aspirator. But if God is breathing and he has a spiritual aspect to him, you can move the respirator because that he's not breathing on his own and the respirator is helping him breathe, so you can remove it because he's not breathing on his own. But you cannot start his heart from breathing because his heart is breathing on its own. On the other hand, it could be the opposite. If his heart is not breathing and he was on a heart machine and he breathes on his own, then he allows him to have a heart machine, but he can't stop him.
Two reasons I won't do it. A, he doesn't say that. He says the person has no independent life.
His alternative case is living.
So long as the person has any degree of independent life, if you think his heart is still getting independent life, then you can't remove... No, it's enough. You can't do anything. You can't remove the respirator if he has any form of independent life. That's his formulation. And secondly, you're not really going to tell me that you have a patient who, right, you have a patient who really is conscious and, right, and has a heartbeat and can write poetry and, right, and procreate and do everything else, but the only thing they can't do is breathe without a machine attached to them.
That's all I'm saying. What I'm saying is, he has his heart is breathing on his own, right? So that's...
You're going to let me remove the respirator from the patient in an iron lung? A conscious person who davens three times a day, puts on sutras, does sukkah, but because they happen to be connected to iron lung, I can unplug the iron lung and that's not murder?
No, that's the thing you have to say from a regular person. In other words, if you have a regular person and then outside, you know, there's something that's going to kill them and you can remove it. Because he has all of the other aspects of life. Okay? When the guy is possessed, whatever that means, in other words, you know that he's not going to make it on his own, but you cannot prolong
Now you want three criteria. Right? The person has to be a good faith, they have to have only some forms of life and not others, and you have to remove the thing which is the source of the external life as opposed to other things.
Yeah,
That's a very complicated formula. I don't see it anywhere that's affiliated with it. Right? And I don't think it's, I think that you're bigger, it goes against so complicated.
Both things kind of sort of take away from the other. And also, both things, the independent part kind of sort of was starting to fail.
I don't know. First of all, I would point out that the Shulchan doesn't say ghost as the defining category. It says, right, as for example, something is a ghost. This seems to imply that perhaps this extends other cases as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Somebody has to define. But the issue is, if you want to leave the limitation to ghost, then that will not help you, right? Because if the ghost is defined a lot as somebody who is dying imminently. People on respirators aren't dying immediately. That's the whole point. The reason you want to take them off the respirator is that they'll live forever. Or for a very long time.
So you take them off.
Yeah, so that's right. So if you want to limit this to ghost face, as opposed to claiming that ghost face is an example of a category, right, then it becomes very much less useful for contemporary medical ethics. So I don't think that it helps to limit the ghost face. I think it will make it not so useful. And a whole bunch of cases. You know me.
Maybe it's not that. Maybe the ghost is the wrong criteria to use. Maybe it's the will to live. And, you know, I know from fact the narrative that you can't take a lot on, but in the idea, it goes back to the person who has the iron lung but can do all of these things and wants to live and so on. You can't take away their reason. But for the person who's dying and doesn't have quality of life, which is how I define it, then you can take away the external part of artificially keeping alive because their soul wants to depart. They're telling you their soul wants to depart, and you're preventing it.
So there's two issues. One is that for the contemporary cases, kind of what I told you, you're usually dealing with unconscious patients. Right, so the notion of expressed will is rarely useful. So then the question is, the issue is that, how much do we regard advanced? Notice that's a really interesting question. If you look at the rest of these studies, right, so you discover that people aren't so good at predicting what they really want. So there's a moral autonomy point, but it's not clear in terms of result you actually get that. But yeah, that might be. It's just that once you start saying some people's worth life is worth living, other people's is not, that scares me. That's where the morphine drip question comes in. Mm-hmm. And I tell you that a friend of Shlomo Zalman allows morphine drip in the belief that morphine drip will kill you. And there's a whole really interesting discussion right now about whether morphine drips, in fact, are inevitably suppressed respiration or not.
I actually went to a discussion on this topic with a group of doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it's not so clear there's really no fine line between where the amount of morphine you're giving is clearly crossing the line. Because in different doses, it depends on the amount of pain and the exact weight of the pain, you get a different amount of morphine. And at some point, it might cause
right. The issue is whether they will...
So where that point is.
But they're all sounding ailments there. And then you have somebody who's like...
Well, the issue is that because of tolerance, right, this is the way, and this, although I've seen some attacks on it, I still think that this is basically compelling, that because you eventually gain tolerance, so once you start somebody on a morphine drip, in order to maintain them comfortable, you will eventually have to hit the dose to a point which is fatal. The issue is that they might very well die before you hit that point. Right, that's issue number one. Issue number two is that there seems to be a time with euthanasia. Is that because morphine drips are legal, so you can't, right, so if you ask, if you run studies on doctors and nurses, right, if you discover that, that euthanasia by morphine drip is in fact rampant, whether or not it is medically inevitable or not. Right? At least people conceive of themselves as performing euthanasia. Right, going around some land. There was an interesting study when I was at Boston Hospital some years ago, which was really quite terrifying about the extent to which patient deaths are consciously caused. That would be, maybe, I don't know. Shlomo Zalman is not there. Shlomo Zalman is not there. I guess it's a terrifying analogy. It says it's like a figuration of a list that way. Right, so it's an inevitable consequence, but it's not what you intend, and there's a position logically the oral for that mutter derived on Shabbat, so why can't it be mutter also? As long as your intent is to release pain, who cares if you kill them? I just find it terrifying that he says that, but I can't deny to you that anyone's list of top 5 folks over the last 3 decades said it. That's not where I want to go. But on the other hand, I also necessarily want to go to people, that you can't do it. I just think that the healthy discussion is not sufficient right now. And people aren't aware of where we really are. Yes. Yeah.
I always thought you shouldn't sign it with less discussion. Maybe you should sign it.
So I think it depends very much on the circumstances under which. So I think that what is clear is that the notion that you always have to resuscitate, right, is a mystery in halakha. The question of whether the circumstances under which the particular codes under which you should resuscitate or not, that seems to be a question that right now you couldn't answer blank in a blanket way, because we don't have the criteria done well enough. That's the problem. Right? Nobody has a clear enough formulation of halakha, so that's, I think, a very careful discussion probably you should have with your poster. I think halakha is not developed to the point where you can answer those questions well. Now that may mean, in the transitional topic here, when we talk about what if your parents find that you uphold it. But I think that there probably should be a bias, a much stronger bias towards the wishes of the patient than there would be if there were a clear halakha. If there were a clear halakha, the kibbutz of aim doesn't override any prohibitions in the Torah. But since halakha is quite vague, I think that unless it's obvious that it violates halakha, it might be that you should give much more deference to the wishes of a patient than you would otherwise. But I don't think that we could give the halakhic guidance on this question unless somebody forces us to, right? If you come to you stop. So I would have to draw an arbitrary line for you, which would conform to my sense of where you ought to be. But I can't tell you that I have a clear understanding of precedent that I can draw the line here and not there and tell you that code 1 through 6, whatever, or blue through yellow, I don't know what it is. I think we're not there. As a group, we spent last summer trying to see if we could get there, and I hope that our tshuva will be online soon and they will advance the discussion. My article is online already, but it's just there to advance the discussion. It's not there to get the results. I don't think we're there. Okay. Yes.
What about the issue of when or whether to put somebody on
the machine? Well,
the food issue is pretty much out of the discussion. If that's put in, then we can't come out. So putting it in at all.
Well, again, that's... That assumes that the relevant distinction is between active and passive.
Right.
Right. So that, again, I'm not, if you ask very many folks, and they will give you answers predicated on a difference, they'll try and distinguish between ordinary medications, which is considered killing to not survive, and extraordinary medications. I don't think that those distinctions are going to last. I don't think they work. Are they where halakha is right now? Yes. Are they?
So my question to you is, do you think that it's halakhically easier to not put them on the chart or make the decision that they're on?
I think it depends on whether there is a chance of recovery. If there is a chance of recovery, then it's very hard to say no. Right? If there's no chance of recovery, then yes, there is more precedent for not putting it on. and for taking it off, but not so much, because you'll see that the way most of the sources say it, what they say is if you shouldn't have put it on, you can take it off. Right, so that distinction, again, I think is not as strong, right, now in the sources as it should be, although that's not to say that most people you ask to talk will not talk in vapor that distinction, as the last right line distinction somebody gave that had any predictive value. Although, you know, philosophically, if you read, for example, Baruch Brody, who's from bioethicist in Texas, has some really powerful attacks on the usefulness of that distinction. Really powerful attacks on it. So I don't find that a terribly useful distinction. But again, you know, I don't find it that way. I'm not trying to present you the consensus halakha. I'm trying to present you. Right. That's where that's why. I don't think that distinction. If I were asking halakha, that would not be the key distinction. But if you ask me practically, yes, you're much more likely to get a heter right now because there's a lot of precedent to deal with. Okay. Yes,
Well, I just want to mention earlier that there's an issue with saying that it has to do with the person that you made in the case where you can kill the system, or you can shoot them.
Right.
So I want to say that perhaps it's also rules from the form of the author that indeed this is how we look at it, and to mitigate the other way to kill them with being a salvation, like Mark Zion.
Marisayan, that's not bad. Marisayan, that's just like a slug of shear in 2 weeks, right? Well, I think that people didn't think, people thought logically it really made a difference between, you know, the Catholic Committee changed it, it's not that the family would feel better because Dr. Steinberg wouldn't accept it otherwise. No, it's to make people feel better. It did for them, right? I don't think it achieved very much, but the way they understand what it does. The discussion that Mario, I don't know, in the end, where people really are much more comfortable with pulling the plug.
It's just in Mark's benefit. Mark's benefit is more possibility to eliminate, like, shooting the neck. Or, like, you know, you can eliminate, like, putting a little poison in. Like, maybe, at the point, it's because it's, I understand the approach, in general, although it's kind of where you stand it out loud, is to basically stay as the case and to mitigate other ways.
I think that certainly has appeal to strategy, if you think it could get far enough. I'm not sure if it gets far enough.
And the other thing I want to say is, unfortunately, the other thing about why can't I use the most efficient approach to power on it, is that I think that here, the first thing is another thing, so what's going to end up killing the end is something internal, something about them. Unfortunately, I shot the arrow, and then the shot that I used was in the chamber, were people that I put in the chamber in the first place.
So did somebody else shot the arrow? I went diving. I attached the scuba gear to myself. Right. All right. That's where people try and make the distinction, natural or unnatural. But then again, that should work for anybody.
Stephen
Hawking.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, somebody that's paraplegic and Iron Lung. Right? So there are many people who are kept alive, right? Any patient on dialysis. Right? Their kidneys don't function. Right? So there are so many people who are genuinely alive in lots of ways because machines keep them alive nowadays. Right, exactly right. So I think that distinction just doesn't, right, that thing just doesn't hold up. We can't base a lot on that distinction now because it just doesn't hold up. There are too many people are not alive by that definition. Too many people are not alive by that definition. But somewhere in there has to be a line. You know, somewhere there has to be a line. We just haven't found it yet. So go away. All right. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Kelly.
Wonderful to see you.
Kelly Howard Kasker is coming Monday night. He's a wonderful speaker and a really important contemporary socialist. And I encourage you all to show up for his speech, which will be speaking about technology on Shabbat, the specific reference to the current controversy about Shabbat.